Welcome to this conflict-free leadership call hosted by the National Physicians Alliance as part of its Unbranded Doctor Project, which takes place under the Partnership to Advance Conflict-Free Medical Education, the PACME grant. I'm Rachel DeGolia. I'll be your facilitator for this call and also am a board member of the National Physicians Alliance. In my day job, I direct the Universal Healthcare Action Network, known as UCAN. So, according to our pre-registrations as of yesterday, we have a very good mix of physicians, faculty, and medical students from across the country, from at least 16 states plus D.C. I'm just going to read them off real quick so you can get the sense of the breadth of the participation on our call tonight. We've got folks on from California, Connecticut, Florida, Illinois, Massachusetts, Maryland, Maine. This is alphabetical order. North Carolina, New Mexico, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, Virginia, Washington, West Virginia, and, of course, D.C. So given how many folks are on the call tonight, we ask everyone to mute your lines at this time. Just press star 6. I'll give you all a moment to do that. Just hit star 6. And then when we get to the Q&A, if there's time and people would like to speak up directly, you can always unmute your line by pressing star 6. And, of course, our speaker needs to do that as well. All righty. So just quick background on the PACME project. The grant that supports this project came from a settlement regarding the inappropriate marketing of the drug Neurontin. And partners for this grant, in addition to the National Physicians Alliance, are AMSA, the American Medical Student Association, Community Catalyst, and the Pew Charitable Trust. The goal of the project is to reduce conflicts of interest created by the pharmaceutical industry in the medical profession and in medical research. So the partners on this grant promote a number of approaches to raise awareness on this issue and to build leadership in the medical profession to eventually eliminate some, if not all, conflicts. These calls are part of that. Before I introduce our guest speaker tonight, I'd like to ask Ann Wallison, NPA's Education Director, to say a few words about the upcoming NPA programs. Ann?
Hey, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us, and thank you, Rachel, for describing the project. I'm not going to keep people very long. I just want to remind people that these calls, along with our nationally webcast, national grand rounds, are all available on the National Physicians Alliance website. And I wanted to let you know to be looking in the next couple of days, the next week, for an invitation to our next national grand round, which will be convened in conjunction with NPA's 9th annual conference in New York on October 24th. So look for that invitation and register for that event, which will be good. And I also wanted to remind people that Lisa Cosgrove, our speaker tonight, did put together a slide set that was sent to you all as part of the 24-hour reminder and the 90-minute reminder for this call. So for those of you that are sitting in front of your computer, you may want to pull that up. But I'm going to stop there, and you'll hear from me later on in the call. And thank you very much, Rachel.
Okay, great. All right.
This is Dick Gerson coming in.
Welcome. Dick and others who've just joined us, if you could please mute your lines and everybody can hear better, it'll be star 6 to do that. And you're welcome to unmute later on during the Q&A, just because we have so many people on the line tonight. Okay, so our topic tonight is Risky Medicine, How Conflict of Interest May Affect Clinical Guidelines and Decision-Making. And our guest speaker, as you all know, is Lisa Cosgrove, PhD, who is a professor at the University of Massachusetts in Boston and a network lab fellow at the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard. Professor Cosgrove is going to discuss tonight with us her research regarding questions and dilemmas that arise when individuals or professional organizations with financial conflicts of interest are involved in the development of clinical practice guidelines and diagnostic tools. As was the case with the revisions included in the DSM-5, fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. She has published extensively, and you had a longer bio in your announcement for tonight. So before I bring Professor Cosgrove on, let me just say a word about how we're going to do this call. She will speak for about 20 minutes, and before we do the Q&A, I'm going to invite the Education and Research Director for AMSA, the American Medical Student Association, Jeffrey Kochi, to say a few words about some of AMSA's resources and new tools available to help reduce conflicts of interest in academic medical centers and in the medical profession. So following those two presentations, we will then invite all of you to address your questions to one or both of our speakers. Given the number of people on this call, we ask that you email your questions, which you can do at any time during the remarks, to Ann Wollison at ann.wollison, W-O-L-L-S-O-N, at npalliance.net. That's ann.wollison at npalliance.net. Email your questions to Ann. She'll compile them and perhaps consolidate a few, and we'll try to address all of them. If we run out of time to get to all of them before the hour is up, we will ask Professor Cosgrove if she could respond to you after the call. Again, if you have not done so already, please mute your lines by pressing star 6. And now I'm very pleased to introduce our guest speaker tonight, Professor Lisa Cosgrove. Welcome, Professor Cosgrove.
Thank you very much. It's really an honor, and I very, very much appreciate this opportunity. I thought I would just start with an anecdote that might give you a sense of how I became interested in the whole issue of the potential for industry to exert an undue influence on diagnostic or practice guidelines. I think it was around 2000-2001, I was doing some menstrual cycle research, and it was at the time when Prozac's patent was set to expire in 99, and they actually got an extension, but to hedge their bets, Eli Lilly put in a new indication for premenstrual dysphoric disorder, even though at the time it was in the appendix of the DSM and not in, as it is in the DSM-5, in mood disorders. So I was doing this research, and I just inadvertently discovered that the vast majority of panel members for PMDB had these ties to Lilly, and they were providing expert testimony to the FDA that PMDB was a, quote, real valid disorder, and that what was then going to be referred to as Seraphim, which is, as you probably know, fluoxetine hydrochloride, was effective in treating it. And so I thought, that's not okay. There's a real conflict there. And I wondered if that was an aberration or if that was something that was problematic throughout the whole DSM. And so I contacted Professor Krinsky, Shelley Krinsky at Tufts, who was a well-known international expert on conflict of interest. And we developed a research design to investigate systematically the financial ties between DSM panel members and industry. So I just wanted to give that as a backstory, because I think sometimes the way that I'm portrayed is that I'm on a witch hunt per se about individuals, and that's not the case. And the second point I just wanted to make before going into the specifics tonight is that my affiliation with the FAFSA Center has been really helpful to me, because I see my work within the institutional corruption framework that the lab uses. And just real briefly, that's a framework that I think is best described as, you know, the focus is on the bad barrel, not the bad apple. And so even though my early work did focus on financial conflicts of interest, where I've moved, the direction that I've moved my work in is away from that, and not seeing it as an individual problem, but rather looking at what are the systemic influences within organized psychiatry that have taken organized psychiatry off course and that have really undermined public trust. So it's a focus on the barrel, if you will, and the systemic influences as opposed to an individual root cause. So that said, I thought it would be of interest for you tonight maybe to hear a little bit about some of the work I've done on the clinical practice guidelines. And specifically, and this is what the PowerPoint slides address. So I've done some pilot research looking at the American Psychiatric Association's guidelines for depression and comparing those guidelines to a subset of other guidelines, guidelines produced by NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, produced from Spain and the Netherlands, and looked at how they are similar and how they're different. So one of the things that my research team and I discovered was that the American Psychiatric Association recommends antidepressants as a frontline treatment for all levels of depression, even mild depression. Now, this actually flies in the face of the evidence. There were two fairly recent meta-analyses, both that received a lot of well-deserved media attention. One was published in JAMA by Fournier and his group, and the other was published by Irvin Kirsch in South Medicine. And I'll just read you two quotes from their work so that you can get a real sense of how strongly the data speak. So this is from Kirsch. Given these data, there seems little evidence to support prescription of antidepressant medication to even the most severely depressed patients unless alternative treatments have failed to provide benefit. Now, that's a direct quote from his conclusion. And what's really interesting about Irving Kirsch's work is that he submitted a FOIA, that's a Freedom of Information Act, and that was a brilliant strategy because a FOIA gives you access to unpublished data. Because, as we know, there's a clear publication bias. So if you do a systematic review, and, you know, even if your search terms are, well thought out, you're still going to get potentially a biased result because there's a bias in favor of publishing studies that support the medication. So by submitting this FOIA, by using a FOIA, he had a really robust data set. And with this robust data set, he couldn't have been more clear in his conclusion. And now I'll just read you a quote from Fournier's group, and this was the one, the meta-analysis on antidepressants that was published in JAMA in 2010. And they write, efforts should be made to clarify to clinicians and prospective patients that there is little evidence to suggest that antidepressants produce specific pharmacological benefit for the majority of patients with less severe acute depression. Again, I think it couldn't be more clear in terms of what the conclusion is based on their meta-analyses. Now, what's interesting is, what does APA say in their clinical practice guidelines? And I'll read you that quote. And I also want you to be aware of the fact that, interestingly, they use Kirsch and Fournier to support this statement. So this is what APA says in their CPD for depression. Response rates in clinical trials typically range from 50 to 75% of patients, with some evidence suggesting greater efficacy relative to placebo in individuals with severe depressive symptoms as compared to those with mild to moderate symptoms. Now, technically, is that sentence true? Absolutely. Technically, it's true. However, it in no way addresses the spirit of either Kirsch or Fournier's work. And it's what's very interesting, like I said, is that they actually cite Kirsch and Fournier, or I would say miscite them, to make that statement. And then in their summary, this is what APA says. Antidepressant medication is recommended as an initial treatment choice for patients with mild to moderate major depressive disorder. So I find this very interesting because if we're in an era of evidence-based medicine and we're looking at the evidence, then clinical guidelines should not vary dramatically. Obviously, there are demographics, there's cultural issues, etc. But in terms of a recommendation like this, there should not be great variation. Well, on one of the slides that is in the PowerPoint, and also I sent it out as an individual slide, my students and I just did a very quick table comparing APA, NICE, the Netherlands, and Spain. And if you are at your computer, then you can take a look at that, or if you just want to make a note at some point to take a look at it. What's very interesting is you see how different the APA's guideline, the U.S. guideline is. We are the only clinical practice guideline, again, in this small subset, but still, we're the only clinical, we're the only country that does not recommend lifestyle interventions such as exercise, and we're the only country that recommends antidepressant medication for mild depression. And also, we're the only guideline that actually recommends, and I bet some of you are not aware of this, it's very dismaying, we're the only guideline that recommends ECT, that's right, electroconvulsive shock therapy for mild depression. And APA's exact quote is, ECT is recommended for, quote, patients who prefer it or who've had a positive experience with it. Again, that's not evidence-based medicine. So if you, you know, just have a chance to take a look at that, I think it's very telling that the differences among the guidelines. What also is interesting, I think, is that the APA recommends augmentation with antipsychotics for all levels of depression, even mild depression, for patients who show no or limited improvement after 4 weeks. And that's not the case with the subset of these other guidelines. What you'll also see in the PowerPoint slide, if it, I hope it it was embedded correctly, I embedded an ad, a direct-to-consumer ad for Abilify. And what I think is interesting about this is it really gets into the issue of informed consent. If you look at the ad, or maybe some of you have seen the ad, it's very hard for a consumer or even a provider to tell that Abilify is an antipsychotic. It's an ad that I think is extremely misleading. It leads a person to believe that Abilify is this add-on to an antidepressant that can boost the antidepressant as opposed to being an antipsychotic. Just as an aside, the newer antipsychotics, the second generation, are often referred to as atypical, but I would suggest that you not use that term because that's actually a marketing term. Industry came up with that because they wanted to promote the idea that they didn't, that the second generation antipsychotics like Abilify did not have the side effect, a negative side effect profile, which, as we're finding out, I think is much more accurate to say that the second generation antipsychotics have a different side effect profile. It's not that they don't have the side effects, and in fact, the movement side effects are have been severely underreported. So, as an aside, I just wanted to let people know about that. So, again, the main takeaway here is the way that the APA's guideline dramatically differs from these three other guidelines. The guideline produced by NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, has this extensive, brilliant review about evidence-based supporting exercise as an intervention for mild depression. And the APA's guideline simply says if the patient wishes to exercise, if a patient with mild depression wishes to exercise, there's little to argue against it. So again, they don't do the thorough review, they're not really promoting exercise in any meaningful way, and this differs dramatically, compared to other countries. The other thing I wanted to mention related to informed consent is, some of you might not be aware, but we and New Zealand are the only two countries in the world that allow direct-to-consumer advertising. And the reason, I think it's because the pharma industry is so powerful in terms of lobbying here, and industry knows it has a very powerful effect. And if you do watch that ad or you watch it at another point, one of the things that's important to notice is, and this is true not just for the psychotropic DTC, the direct-to-consumer ads, but for all of them, the point at which they list the negative side effects is the point at which the visual is the most aesthetically pleasing, happiest, and that's purposeful because they've done research to show that, you know, typically people are taken in more by the visual than the audio. So as we see this visual, we're paying less attention to the side effects, which, again, I think the FDA should be made aware of. Also, you know, for me, one of the big issues here is informed consent. Again, I think sometimes I have been portrayed as anti-medication, which I'm not. I'm not a prescribing provider. My PhD is in clinical psychology. I would have no right to make a recommendation, but I'm not anti-medication. To me, the issue really is about informed consent. If someone with mild depression wants to try an antidepressant in this country, should they have that as an option? I believe absolutely. But what they should be told is that other guidelines do not recommend this, but the evidence base on average suggests that it's not effective for mild depression, but it certainly could be in, you know, for an individual. But the people are not aware of the other choices and other interventions. And in the United States, 80% of antidepressant medication prescriptions are actually written by PCPs or nurse practitioners. They're not written by psychiatrists. A lot of people are surprised to find that out, but what I find dismaying is that most people, I think most prescribing providers, turn to APA's guidelines, you know, to inform their practice and not having awareness that this guideline might not be trustworthy. And then I don't think on the slide that I handed out, but that I would like to certainly let you know because I think it is important. Every single one of the authors, the panel members for that guideline produced by APA had strong ties to the pharmaceutical companies that manufacture the antidepressants, and most were actually on speakers' bureaus. And as I'm sure you're aware, since you're part of this group, industry refers to participation on speakers' bureaus as individuals who are key opinion leaders because they know they get big-name physicians who can go out and talk to other physicians and really change prescribing practices. And as I'm sure you're aware of, you know, medical schools have now said, well, if you're on a speakers' bureau, that's too much of a conflict of interest because we're concerned about the dissemination of balanced information to medical students. And yet the APA allows, in contrast to IRM's most recent guidelines, has allowed this. And they just had a statement saying that this was reviewed by an independent panel and they found no evidence that these financial ties would have any effect. And I'm going to be conscious of time here, but the last thing I just wanted to say in terms of that is, again, I don't think these are bad people. I don't think there's a Machiavellian plot where Dr. Smith is doing some backdoor deal with Eli Lilly. That's not the problem at all. I think that these psychiatrists really, the guild interests are at play, and so that they really believe the medications work. And it's very difficult, I think, it creates a real dissonant state, think about it psychologically, to believe that these medications that you're prescribing might not be efficacious and that the risk-benefit ratio might not be that good. So the analogy I often make is, you know, if a cardiologist finds out that a drug she was prescribing really did have a much poorer, you know, side effect profile or a bad risk-benefit ratio, he or she has other tools in the toolbox. The psychiatrists in the United States are predominantly psychopharmacologists. They're prescribing these medications. And so I think it makes it very difficult for people to assimilate that information. And also that what we found is transparency as a solution to the potential for real or the appearance of bias is an insufficient solution, and it can actually have its own iatrogenic effects. In fact, some social scientists have found that when people disclose their financial ties, and again, these are simulated conditions, but when people disclose their ties, they actually give more biased advice. So the idea that transparency is a robust enough solution to prevent the appearance or the reality of bias is, I think, very naive. A very naive one. And then the last thing I'll just mention, and then to make sure we have time for the other speaker, is that one of the studies that I published recently in the spring, Shelley Krinsky and I looked at what were the RCTs that were in the pipeline for DSM-5 disorders before the DSM-5 came out, which is, I think, an interesting question because, of course, no one should know whether these disorders were going to be approved to be in the DSM, but clearly there was inside, information. And the FDA never simply, as you know, approved the drug. There has to be an indication for it. And so some of you might be interested in that because what our data, I think, clearly tell us is that the DSM-5 is operating, inadvertently at least, as a vehicle for high-profit patent extension. For example, Cymbalta's Eli Lilly produces Cymbalta, and the patent for Cymbalta expired in December of 2013. Cymbalta accounted for 24% of Eli Lilly's revenue. That's huge. So obviously Lilly has a fiduciary responsibility to their sharekeepers and would be motivated to make sure they don't lose 24% or, a significant amount of their profits. But what's fascinating to me is two of the most controversial newly included disorders, well, one newly included disorder in the DSM, binge eating disorder, has a trial for Cymbalta. And then, as you might be aware of, another very controversial change in the DSM-5 was the elimination of the bereavement exclusion, so that now someone who lost a loved one could be diagnosed with major depressive disorder if they exhibit 5 symptoms of depression after 2 weeks. Prior to that, in DSM-4 and earlier editions, they had the exclusion recognizing that grief was part of the normal human experience and you didn't want to pathologize someone's grieving process. And so now there's a trial of Cymbalta for grief-related depression as well as for binge eating disorder. And I think if you look at that, you really see that it appears that commercial interests are driving the RCTs, which drugs are going to be studied as opposed to scientific evidence. If you look at binge eating disorder, you'll see that there are 3 totally different drugs in the pipeline. One, of course, being Cymbalta, another Vyvanse, which is a psychostimulant, which is crazy, in my opinion, to have a stimulant prescribed for, which will be given primarily to women with binge eating disorder. A quote, mood stabilizer, again, another marketing term, Lamictal, is also in the pipeline for approval for binge eating disorder. And the reason that that is very controversial, that newly included disorder, is because the boundaries are so loose. Binge eating disorder is diagnosed in people in the absence of anorexia or bulimia, and you only need 3 symptoms. And those 3 symptoms are if you've eaten until you're uncomfortably full, if you've eaten when you're not hungry, and if you've eaten too rapidly. If you've done that, if anyone on the line has done that once during the last week, over the course of the last few months, you could get diagnosed with binge eating disorder. So that gives you a sense of, just how wide these diagnostic boundaries are, how easy it would be to, do Americans overeat? Absolutely. But should we consider it an intra-individual disorder? I would argue no. And I certainly don't think we should be treating it with a psychostimulant or Cymbalta or Lamictal. So I know I threw a lot of information at you. I want to make sure there's time for the other speaker and certainly time for Q&A. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Cosgrove. All right. Let me just remind folks that if you have questions for Professor Cosgrove, a great way to share them with her will be to email Ann Wollison, because then Ann can make sure we get them asked and perhaps compile some that are similar. It's ann.wollison@npalliance.net. But before we get to those, first I would like to invite Dr. Jeff Kochi, Education and Research Director for AMSA, to make an initial response to Professor Cosgrove's presentation and also to share some information with us about resources AMSA has on this topic. Dr. Kochi, you with us?
I am. Thank you very much, Rachel.
There you are. Great.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's really great to be with everybody tonight and talking about these important issues. As I was listening to Dr. Cosgrove's presentation, I really appreciated the distinction and the metaphorical distinction she makes between the bad apples and the bad barrel. Because in my role and with EMSA, we're working with the apples while they're still on the tree. And
I love it.
they're really nice. They're great metaphors. So thank you for gifting us with that, because I think it'll be very helpful to have as we have conversations with medical students and residents, as well as with administrators and faculties within the medical schools and the residency program. I have a few thoughts that is sort of in response to what Dr. Cosgrove was speaking about. And, within AMSA, we're working with physicians in training. So we're working with students who are pre-medical students at the university level and medical students who are at some point within their medical education. And what comes up so frequently in conversation with our members and with medical students who are aware of conflict of interest as a pertinent issue for medical education is a question of what do I trust? What information can I trust to go to for unbiased guidance and learning about clinical decision making, whether it's with respect to a particular pharmaceutical agent or to a treatment modality? A question comes up frequently: what guides can I use that I can trust as being unbiased and evidence-based? These are really tough questions because the market is filled now with apps and guidelines marketed to medical students and physicians in training that help them learn the different treatment modalities and the different pharmaceutical agents that are available. And very apropos to this conversation, I received an email this afternoon from a former AMSA student leader who was our Just Medicine Fellow last year, Teddy Segrelius, who's now a fourth-year medical student at University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and he is currently going through his OB-GYN rotation. And he was doing some practice questions in a QBank that is published by ASCO, the Association of Professors of Gynecology and Obstetrics. And he sent me a screenshot of this question that he found in the QBank. And I'm going to read the question stem, and then I'm going to read to you the credited answer. The question is, you are asked to give a lecture on a new chemotherapy drug that has demonstrated a reasonable efficacy in women with advanced cervical cancer. The day before giving the lecture, you realize that you own stock in the company that makes the drug. Which of the following statements about conflict of interest is true? The credited answer, and I'm using credited very intentionally here, is this. Pharmaceutical companies can support the cost of medical conferences in which physicians receive continuing medical education credit. That is the credited answer. And our former Farm-Free Fellow took a screenshot of this and sent it to me basically with, what the WQF? And, this is what he is encountering in his medical education. And you can see, just by this one anecdotal sample, that these issues, that this is insidious. It comes up when students least expect it. And only the most aware students are going to even pick up on this. So you talk about the hidden curriculum. I mean, here's example, exhibit A for the hidden curriculum within this medical school. So he has actually forwarded this screenshot to our Just Medicine Steering Committee, and they are now writing a letter to APCO with references to policy guidelines on continuing medical education that have been published through the PACNI project. And, you know, this is a fantastic example of student activism empowered by knowledge. And, you know, what AMHSA is trying to do with respect to conflicts of interest in medical education is empower students to speak up on their behalf and on behalf of the integrity of their medical education, which ultimately on behalf of the integrity of their ability to practice patient-centered care. Our medical students do not want to practice medicine that is less than patient-centered care. And we have allowed a system to develop over the years that now inculcates less than patient-centered care. And we need to stand up to that, claim medical education back for students, back for the profession, back for the ideals of the profession, and back for patient-centered care. So some of the tools we've created over the years to empower students, most notably our AMHSA scorecard, which now is in its eighth year of publication. And over the last few years, we have been engaged in a significant methodological revision and expansion project as part of the PACNI grant to increase the rigor of the scorecard methodology and to expand the scorecard scope to include teaching hospitals. So in its original form, the scorecard covered medical schools and evaluated medical schools on about a dozen or so different domains across conflicts of interest. The current scorecard now addresses a total of 14 different domains across and applies that to the medical schools and applies them to teaching hospitals. For those of you who might be in front of a computer or who will want to reference this later, you can view the scorecard at amhsascorecard.org, and I will give you just that one email, just that one web address, because you can access the teaching hospital scorecard from that address, as well as the scorecard for medical school. And to give you a sense of what domains are addressed within the scorecard, we evaluate schools on their policies relative to gifts, to meals, to speaking relationships, to CME, promotional events, scholarships and awards that are supported by the industry, ghostwriting, consulting, sales reps, access, device rep access, disclosure, COI curriculum, COI policy extension, and enforcement. For the teaching hospitals in particular, we also evaluate them on their policies relative to pharmaceutical samples and to pharmacy and therapeutics committee policies. So it's a fairly comprehensive scorecard evaluation. These are based on recommendations from an expert task force that was convened by two charitable trusts about 2 years ago, which included COI compliance officers, medical school faculty, medical school administration representatives, folks from the AAMC, and medical students, as well as representatives of patient advocacy groups. So this is a very important tool, in our view, of empowering students, or for the purpose of empowering students, to advocate for their own education and ultimately to advocate for the integrity of the profession. Since I mentioned at the beginning, you know, this anxiety that students have or this worry that students have about what resources they can rely on or go to, which are conflict-free or bias-free, AMHSA works very carefully to associate with companies that provide services and educational resources that are conflict-free. So, for example, we have a partnership with with Oakstone Publishers, who publish a tool called Practical Reviews. And these are point-of-care tools that are explicitly created, unbiased, and are conflict-free. And we market these types of tools to our members as educational resources that they can use and trust, knowing that they are free of conflict and knowing that they are free of bias from industry ties. So this just gives you a sense of what we do within AMHSA. There's much more that goes on within our Just Medicine campaign, which looks globally at conflicts of interest across healthcare systems, medical education, and healthcare economic policy. So we address not just conflicts of interest within medical education, but also international trade agreements and the impact on access to medicine. We also look at open access of publicly funded research and research products, and advocate for increasing the public accessibility of products and knowledge that have been publicly funded.
Thank you. All right. We've had two really meaty presentations here, and I bet there's a lot of questions. Keep them coming one more time. Email ann.wolosson@ntalliance.net. Okay, Ann, let's hear the first question.
Hi. Thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Lisa. Great, great presentations. And this was the first question we received. Jeff kind of touched on it a little bit, giving an example, but just to see if Lisa has anything else to add, are you aware or familiar with other specialties that may be in question where specific treatment guidelines may be under the Pharma Influence, COI, that we as medical students should or may think about trying to become more aware of?
Yes, actually. It was a CPG produced by, I'm trying to remember, it was the, I can't remember now the organization, I can get it to you, but at any rate, there was a lot of controversy. You might have heard about it. It was around the use of statins and the change in what was considered, a bad cholesterol level. And there's a great little op-ed in DMJ about this, and it would increase, if you follow these guidelines, it would increase the number of people being prescribed statins in the U.S. alone by 7.5 million. And, unbelievably, according to these guidelines, every single African-American male over age 65, regardless of cardiovascular events, regardless of cholesterol levels, would be put prophylactically on statins. And as one person said, that's a big kiss to big pharma. So that's one that I do know has raised a lot, and folks had undisclosed ties to the manufacturers of statins. So that I know has received a great deal of controversy.
All right, thank you.
That's great, thank you.
And
it ties into what you were talking about earlier, Lisa, so I'll ask the question without trying to get too off track, but can you talk a little bit more about the FOIA process? Was it filed with a researcher or manufacturer, and were there trade secret issues? Are they required to provide the information when requested?
The FOIA is a Freedom of Information Act that you just, I don't know, I've never submitted one myself. I'm not sure of the process by which you do this, but in terms of the research that I do and probably the interest of the participants, the transparency now of clinicaltrials.gov should help so that people wouldn't need FOIA. That said, I just went to an interesting presentation where the person looked at, trying to assess how transparent pharmaceutical companies were being in terms of following the guidelines for clinicaltrials.gov. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of variation. So some companies are better than others. So the bottom line is, I don't know where you would submit as a U.S. citizen, you know, I don't know the process by which you submit the FOIA for the RCTs, but I could try to find that out. But hopefully, the short answer is hopefully clinicaltrials.gov will aid so that doing a FOIA is just, it's a hard, like anything with the government, imagine submitting a form to the government and getting a response. So you have to persevere and wait a while. So it's not an easy process.
Lisa, let me jump in because we had some experience with FOIA in our research for the scorecard. As we were evaluating the teaching hospitals, we decided to evaluate the VA hospitals as an entire category. And for many hospitals, we were able to acquire them simply through public searches. But for a number of policies, we actually were told that in order to get those policies, we would have had to file a FOIA request. So, and we didn't, unfortunately, we didn't have time to do that. So, the fact that some of the policies that govern our publicly funded healthcare system are not available to the public except to go through this time-consuming, difficult, and frankly, interesting process. So, you know, transparency at that level is made all the more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, Ann, you got another one for us?
Yeah, I'm going to, I just received one that is in line with one that I received earlier, so I'm going to combine the two of these. Do you feel that the federal government's new open payment system will ultimately change or lead to change in terms of how panel members are selected? And then the second part of that, because it ties into it, I believe, do you think there will be a shift of money to advocacy organizations? It's very hard to document their pharma funding rather than directly to physicians.
Hmm. Right. Yeah, in terms of the second part of the question, there's a colleague of mine at the SAPA Center, Susanna Rose, R-O-S-E, and if you Google her name, Susanna Rose, PhD, I think she's at the Cleveland Clinic, she's written about and researched the ties between the advocacy groups and industry and the ways that that can have some corrupting influences. So I just wanted to make sure I remember to say that because that could help people. And then just in terms of the first part of the question again was...
Could you repeat it again?
Yeah, sure. Do you feel that the federal government's new open payment system will ultimately change or lead to change?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You mean that in terms of how panel?
The Sunshine Act.
The Sunshine Act, is that you're referring to?
Yes. That's what you're referring to. I believe yes.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just too old and tested this kid, but I think it might have some effect, but I think it won't have as much as one would hope. I'm hoping that, you know, the ION came out in 2011 with a policy that said, guidelines for developing trustworthy CPGs. And they were very clear that at all costs, panel members should not have financial ties. So what I hope will happen is that, you know, there'll be some oversight around that. That, you have to, for a CPG to be seen as potentially trustworthy, you'd have to follow the minimum standards of ION. And so if you can raise awareness of that, you know, that where if the majority of folks, for example, have financial ties, you're not following, and the chair has ties, you're not following ION's standards. One of the things that, I'm working on with some colleagues that I was pleasantly shocked to get the NIH funding for, and miracles do happen, is that what we're developing a instrument that will be hopefully clinician-friendly basically for clinicians to quickly assess in kind of a close way whether a guideline is trustworthy, at risk, or not trustworthy. Because currently the only validated and reliable tool is called the AGREE instrument, and it's just arduous. It's really for researchers. I don't see how two people have to do it and reach consensus, and it's just not, it doesn't have clinical utility for the busy physician. So what we want to do is, what we got funding for is to develop this so that then, and hopefully it would be an app or be on AHRQ's website so that you could quickly, you know, again, in a very rudimentary way, assess whether the guidelines are at risk. So hopefully, you know, we'll be able to do that, and that will be another tool that clinicians would be able to use.
That's really helpful to know about. I'd like to learn a little bit more about that. Most of these questions start out with thanks for a great presentation to you both, by the way, just want to let you know that. And I wanted to invite somebody to just make a comment, but I have another question. And I don't know whether this is easy to answer or not, but can you name some other marketing terms that we use every day? You mentioned atypical and mood stabilizers. I believe this questioner states as examples, and how much, if anything, has changed in terms of DSM panel CLI since you first encountered with the issue?
In terms of the first part of the question about the terms, let's see. I can't think of any offhand, but what I will say is that I think what I try to teach, I teach a psychopharm class, and what I teach my doc students is to use the generic terms. It's easier to remember the branded names, but we're doing the pharmaceutical companies a service by calling it Zimbalta, like I just did. So to just try to be aware of using the generic name as much as possible. And then in terms of the second question about the DSM, Shelley and I replicated our earlier studies in 2006 and looked at the panel members and the good news is that APA did institute a disclosure policy. The bad news is it did not have any effect in terms of really lessening the number of folks with ties. The average number was virtually the same, 57% of all the panels had ties. And although some of the panels decreased, for example, in 2006, we found that DSM-4 panel members, 100% of the folks that were on the mood disorders and schizophrenia panels had ties. And, of course, that's, you know, pharmacological treatment is the standard treatment for those disorders. It went down, so it's not 100%, but still the majority of folks on DSM-5 had ties. So, again, I think it's another, it's more empirical evidence that transparency is an insufficient solution.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I just wanted to invite Dr. Steve Smith, who's one of our project partners, to come on to the call, who had a comment regarding specific to who's prescribing these atypical antipsychotics. I'll use the word, sorry. Steve, are you still with us?
Unmute your line, Steve, if you are. I know he was on at the beginning, and he may not be there still. And maybe better move on to the next question.
Rachel, we may have lost Anne, and we're coming up on 10 o'clock here.
Yeah, sorry, I all of a sudden lost contact there, too, but I can hear you now. Okay.
And I did, too. I lost contact for a second as well.
I think it was the whole conference call, but we're back. All right, so Steve, are you there, Steve Smith? Maybe not.
Hey, Steve, sorry.
Oh, there you are. Okay, great. Okay. Did you hear any questions?
Yeah, just as Ann said that, my phone call dropped, so sorry about that.
But I think it was all of us, Steve.
Oh,
what's that?
I think it was all of us. We'll complain to freeconference.com, but meanwhile, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, Lisa, I wanted to thank you so much for the talk and for your research. I think it's just so important, so valuable. I wanted to add one comment about the statin panel. You know, like you said, about 57% of the members on that panel were had financial ties to industry. Another cardiovascular panel came out recommending a change in blood pressure criteria that would result in actually fewer people being on drugs, and only a quarter of the members on that panel had financial ties. And that's obviously not cause and effect, but it's an interesting association. But I did want to mention about the slide you had about 80% of prescriptions for antidepressants are written by PCPs. You know, that's a fact. I'll argue with that fact, but it could be misinterpreted. And as a family physician, I just wanted to put in this plug that, you know, I don't think the fault lays at our feet that 20% of psychiatrists are not free and clear from this. Every patient I have seen with depression who's on aripiprazole, I'll use the generic for Abilify, was started on that drug by a psychiatrist. I've not yet seen a single patient on Abilify who was started by a PCP. So I think the psychiatrists and the psychiatric APRNs are sort of setting the field, and that the primary care physicians are getting their cues from that realm. Just wanted to put that in.
That's a very good point. Point well taken. Yes.
All right. Well, you know what? We're at the end of our hour here. I know there's more questions. Would you be willing to let us forward some of them to you, Dr. Cosgrove, and for those we couldn't get to?
Absolutely.
And by the way, would you be willing to share your email address for folks who might want to email you directly who are on the call?
Oh, sure. It's easy. It's lisa.cosgrove, my last name, C-O-S-G-R-O-V-E, @ UMB, as in UMass Boston, .edu.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. This has been a terrific call. The audio recording and notes will be posted shortly at npalliance.org/conflict-free, along with the recordings and notes and also the PowerPoint slides from previous calls in this series of NPA Conflict of Interest calls. Anne, is there anything else you'd like to say? I'm not sure if we have another call in this series that we'll be scheduling in the next month or so.
Yes, we'll be doing a call in November, and it will be a summary of all our partners' project work over the course of the last 3 years. Again, look for the invitation. Thank you so much, Lisa, and thank you, Jeff. This has been a great call, and thanks for your questions. It makes my job a lot easier.
Yes.
All right, everybody.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.